You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
You're trying to hide. All right, here we go. Are you ready?
I was just relaxing, but you know.
Yeah, whatever, man. All right, here we go. Tommy Starr with you on the Sound Atlas, and in the studio with me today, a big-time friend of the local music scene. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for the one and only Finner Kastner. Hello, Finner.
Howdy.
How you doing?
Howdy, everybody out there in Radio Land.
So you're here today. We're going to be talking to you about Lord knows what, but probably a lot to do with the local music scene, since this is basically a podcast about the local music scene.
Mm-hmm.
And local music scene, which you've been involved in for how many years now?
Oh, don't give me that question.
Like 30 years?
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good estimate, yeah.
About 30 years. What year did you join your first band? First band that did something, like recorded
that
a song,
something.
Played a gig at a club?
Well, the first one, I mean, I was in a few little upstarts before then. But the first one that did anything that actually started playing around, I mean, I met a dude named Mike Grimes, who most of you guys will know as Grimy now, who owns Grimy's Records and runs the basement bars down in Nashville now. But back then, he was just a little, you know, up-and-coming kind of guitar player that Ken Smith was kind of touting him at the time. They were calling him Blind Melon Jizz Boy. Don't ask me an explanation, or, you know, it's just one of those things. And I went out on a kind of a referral from a friend. He said, man, this guy's great. You got to go out and see him. And I was like, okay. So I went out there, and they were, you know, just shooting the bull and whatever, and playing whatever songs came off the top of their heads and stuff.
You can say shit. It's a podcast. If you need
okay.
to. Yeah.
Well, that felt good.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I really dug what was going on and stuff, and I think we exchanged phone numbers, and then he called me back, I guess probably about a day or so later, and we just started, you know, just talking. I mean, we must have talked about a couple hours that night, and he wanted to get something to put something together.
Mm-hmm.
The very first thing we did was kind of a hit and miss type thing. They called it the Killer Daisies, and it didn't go anywhere. I mean, we got up to play maybe once or twice, and we had kind of a strange dude that was singing for us, but his name I can't remember, but he was kind of an interesting type.
You say the Killer Daisies?
Yeah.
You know, there's a band now called the Dead Daisies.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so that didn't go anywhere, but him and our bass player at the time, well, no, actually, I think Keith Herrick was the bass player in that one. But we hooked up with another bass player named Michael Romanowski, who's out in San Francisco, I think, now. Doing at a mastering lab.
Hmm.
Oh, he's doing pretty good for himself. So we started just kind of riffing around and playing, you know, or trying to write some songs, but we didn't have a vocalist. So they went down to Nashville. I think they were going to see a show or something, and they met this guy named George Cohn in the parking lot of somewhere, and he kind of like pulled him up. Hey, you guys look like rock and roll dudes. Like, hey, you want to play in a band or something kind of like that? I don't know if it actually went down like that.
Yeah.
But they said, yeah. And we started practicing with him. He had a bunch of songs. He had, well, I know about two or three that were already pretty much in the can and recorded with another band. So that was kind of our audition with him. So we went and we actually re-recorded those down in Nashville and put together a little EP. And I'm not sure who came up with the name. I might have actually had a little bit to do with it, but I can't remember exactly whose idea it turned out to be. But Go-Go Surreal was the band
Go-Go
that
Surreal
came out of that one.
Mm-hmm.
And We got on a couple of pretty good good bills. One time we did, I think we opened up for Webb Wilder twice. The second time I had quit the band. But the first time, it was standing room only.
Yeah. This is when Webb was first kind of super hot, and you were like, holy cow, we're opening up for Webb Wilder.
Yeah, came from Nashville, I think was the only thing that was out there, and it was, you know, on vinyl, and, you know, everybody was just, you know, he was pretty much the shit, you know, and we were all like, wow, this is great. But yeah, it was a pretty cool experience, and I think it might have been one of the first couple times that I played Exit In.
Mm-hmm. So Go Go Surreal, now you guys did record some tunes, right?
Yeah, we did a little EP of about 5 or 6 songs, maybe 7. And I think you guys had a couple of them. Sorry.
Don't be slapping around our microphone. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I know we submitted a few of them to you all for the home cooking show.
Mm-hmm. And this is back to the original home cooking in 88, 89.
Back with, you know, Brian and all.
Yeah. But of course I've played them before when I did home cooking. There's home cooking and then there's home cooking with Tommy Starr. Yeah. That's the one I did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, this was the one that they wanted like a reel to reel of it. Mm-hmm. So, when you put those tracks, I think on the tracks from the trunk, they came from that reel, right?
I believe so.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild how those two are together, how that, you know, kind of went full circle, because originally you guys were on the first home cooking that was around 88, 89. Mm. And then when we released the tracks from the trunk, like 2006, I believe, I did put one of those tracks on there.
Because we don't even have a copy of, I have a cassette that I've had for years, but, you know, the quality of what you guys have got was, you know, like 10 times what we had. Didn't even give us masters or anything, I guess.
Did you, when you say you recorded something, did you release it? I mean, did you guys release
the
tape?
We just put it on a tape and just
gave it to friends.
Yeah, sold it at shows.
I don't have that. Like, I don't think I have a Go Go Surreal cassette tape. It's got a J card and everything.
Yeah, we did a few of them. I don't know if I even have. I know I've got the one I always go to is just like a Maxell tape that had the master, but I don't even know. I haven't seen the one with the J card in years, but I may have one somewhere floating around. But yeah.
So Go Go Surreal. We're talking late '80s. You guys did release what it was?
88, 89.
Was it a 4-track cassette?
About 7.
About so, 7 songs. So it was nearly a full.
It was, you know, 17 and 1 was on there. Pretty Priscilla, which is, I think, the song that you guys played a bit.
Mm-hmm.
She Would Stare. God, what was the other ones?
What happened with that band that you left that band? You said that you did 2 shows on the web, and one of them you were not part of the band.
We were starting to have some differences going on. As the band was kind of started growing a little bit, we started kind of, you know, trying to flesh out tunes a little bit more when George wasn't too crazy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of was ribbing him about, he'd been with about 3 or 4 girlfriends in the time that we were. Uh-huh. And about every other song was, you know, about getting fucked over by some girl, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we were like,
dude, we did three songs like that already.
And, you know, when we were like, you know, you're not playing it fast enough, you know, and you're slowing it down, or, you're, you know, you're changing stuff, you know, I want it to be like this. And I was like, no, we want to grow, you know. And so I guess I butted heads with him, and there was a few times that was just like, I don't know if I'm kind of, you know, all on board with this anymore. So I kind of issued my, you know, resignation of sorts. They did one final gig, and I think it was another Webb Wilder opener.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it's actually the actual poster, if you go to Mellow Matt's, is over it up on the wall.
Oh, really?
And I don't know who did it, but it, the funny thing is, we put a couple of pictures in some of the flyers, but not very often. But This one had a just kind of one of those photo booth shots. And the guy, I think there was, you know, Romo was in the front, you know, all you can see is his, like, his head and his nose, and, you know, and the other guys are pretty well framed, and you can recognize Mike and stuff. But the drummer, I looked at her and was like, man, that kind of looks like me, but it's not me. I know it's not me, because that was a weird thing. And they colorized it. I mean, it's actually a cool little poster.
Yeah, I know what you're talking. I know that poster.
Yeah. Most of the other ones, I was going through and kind of playing with, like, you know, the idea of the name and like the surreal. So I'd go and look up, you know, all these surrealistic pictures and stuff, and put them on there and put the logo on it and stuff. And
so the one you're talking about that looks like it's kind of color tinted, that photo, it's got the heads kind of stacked.
Yeah.
Kind of like Kiss Dynasty a little bit.
I like that one.
You're not in that photo.
I'm not in that photo.
That's what the other guy
is. Yeah, that's the other guy. He played one gig with him. I don't know what
his name
was.
And that
was
it. Yeah. Was Grimy in that photo?
Yeah.
Okay. So, kids, if you're listening, if you happen to have that or you know someone that's got it, you can get it and sometime, you know, go down and have Grimy sign it for you. There we go. Now, you've been
steal it off the wall.
You've been in way too many bands for us to talk about all the bands. You've been in like 372 bands.
Really?
So, well, that's what I've heard. I heard you were in Judas Priest for a minute, but not a lot of people know that. Mm. But we're going to jump around a little bit to some bands that kind of pop up when I think of you. One in particular that came up, I guess, a couple of years, or I don't remember, around the same time, maybe Go-Go Surreal wrapped up, was Daddy Longleg.
Yeah.
So, Daddy Longleg, what year did that band get together?
I'm thinking 91, 92. I'd have to look at the cassette when we recorded that. But, yeah, I think that's kind of the time that it was.
Now, let's tell everybody who was in that band, Daddy Longleg.
Okay, Daddy Longleg was actually, you know, it was remnants of the previous band that we had together called Fortress, and we had finally gotten kind of the band together in that, but minus one guitarist. That band had a dude named Alan Bays on vocals, and we put Alan through the ringer with that band because we were asking him all sorts of just crazy things to sing. I mean, the poor guy was, you know, having to growl Metallica songs because we were about the only band that was playing Metallica covers in the town at that time. Plus, we were doing Ozzy Osbourne, so you got, and you're like, you know, all the way up in the roof. And the poor, I mean, he would lose his voice just about every night. but bless his heart, man, he stuck in there, and it was fun with him. And the other guitarist that wasn't in Daddy Longleg was Greg Compton.
And we're talking pre-Daddy Longleg Fortress.
Yeah, this is pre-Daddy Longleg. We had gotten an old bass player friend, Greg Walker, to play in that band, and then there's Mike Thompson, who rounds it out as the main lead guitar guy in that one, and me. So Fortress split up, and I guess we were just kind of, we weren't sick of each other, but through one thing or another, just people couldn't commit or whatever.
Were you mostly a cover band at that
point? Yeah, it was pretty much, we were doing mostly that. I don't think we hadn't written anything yet. And so Mike was always talking about, you know, I wish we had, you know, Ed in here with us, because Mike and Ed go back to the 3035 band. And Eddie could sing pretty much anything he put in front of him. I mean, they were doing the Queensryche covers in that band. They were doing, I guess, Zeppelin and, you know, pretty much all the big metal hits of the day, because that was back probably about the same time that Go-Go Surreal was kicking around, because I know the Audio Tracker?
Yep.
Is that little rag?
Multi-tracker.
The Multi-Tracker.
Multi-tracker.
They were on the cover of that, and we were on it. So I've got both of those somewhere. I kind of remember that from that.
Let me throw a note out. Those of you listening wondering what the Multi-Tracker was. The Multi-Tracker at one time was kind of like the local entertainment kind of a local entertainment fanzine.
The precursor to the Amplifier.
Yeah, it was, I think it came out once a month.
Yeah.
And would usually have, I don't know, it wasn't very thick. It was like maybe 10 or...
Like a little, almost like a fanzine.
Yeah.
The, size, small little...
Kind of looked like a fanzine. Yeah. Not like, you know, it was and on it was, pink paper with black type. They, and, but it was cool.
Yeah, they put it out. I mean, it was very much, you know, kind of a homemade process type thing. But it was still, you know...
Yeah.
It had interviews.
It was great. It was
a good little rag while they were doing it.
And you guys were on that. And you mentioned Go-Go Surreal. I think Go-Go Surreal was on the cover for one time, weren't they?
Yeah, it was. They had the infamous roof shot.
That's
on
right.
there with the infamous mullet. That I once had one. Yes.
That's okay. I did too.
I've got a framed picture of it.
Mine was an accidental mullet, but that's okay. I still had one. But anyway, so 3035 was a band that was kicking around about the same time Go-Go Surreal. Yeah. You guys took parts 3035 and put it with parts Fortress and formed Daddy Longleg.
Yeah. And once we got together with Ed and everybody in the same room, it clicked and we knew we had something. So we went for it there. I don't know. It seems like that Mike probably had a few ideas already kind of under his hat for that. I can't really remember too much about the songwriting process because it seemed like, he would just, he'd throw a song out there, and it wasn't like it was a finished demo or anything. He'd have a riff and we'd all kind of fall in with it. But, but it was, we had enough to do the album, Hoodle Doings, which was, I guess, about 9 or 10 tracks or so.
Well, before that, didn't you guys have a cassette, or was that cassette just something that made it around to some friends?
We called the 9 tracks from a kind of a failed attempt at a first demo that we did with my buddy Brad Jones down in Nashville. We basically pretty much got, what we paid for. We gave him $100 and we went and pretty much tracked everything we knew. It was like about 18 tracks or so. And they were, it was in basically a warehouse type venue that they first had Brad's studio, Alex the Great, set up in. And you can hear, pretty much the room from the, just the quality of the tapes and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've got all the slaves and the, all the 8-track or the multi-track. See, we did it on, it wasn't ADATS. It was,
Didn't you do them on a DAT tape?
No, it wasn't a DAT tape. It was I guess it was a DAT.
Seemed like you told me that...
The VHS, when they had the DAT players. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how they kind of exist. And we gave those to Dave Barrick to try to kind of salvage some of those to remix. But Brad had kind of done some stuff with some of the drum tracks on some of it. And some of the best tracks we couldn't salvage because... He did some kind of print or doubling effect.
Just whatever he did, it was hard to pick through.
Well, it couldn't be undone, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he rescued about 2 or 3 songs that really, cleaned up pretty well. And we said, well, this probably is the guy that we need to go with. So that's how we hooked up with Barrick. Mm-hmm. And then decided to go ahead and do the whole the album.
Mm-hmm. I would say, as a local music fan, that Daddy Longleg, one of the first serious rock bands to kind of get out there and do it to it in the local music scene. I know there's been a lot of bands before Daddy Longleg, but I'm talking straight up, kind of hard rock, we'll say, as far as I can recall. There may be some bands that I'm not familiar with, but kind of music that I'm talking about, kind of harder rock, I would say Daddy Longleg, one of the first around these parts.
Wouldn't I know you say? There was a few kicking around at the time. I think there was one band called Crier, I think that was kind of our direct...
That's true.
Direct
Crier was, but they were from down around the Franklin area,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, they weren't based in Bowling Green.
I don't know if they actually had a release out or not.
I don't think so.
I'm not for sure, but I'm familiar with those guys. Crier. Yeah.
Brian White.
That's a good band. Good band. But I would say, if somebody asked me, I would say probably Daddy Long Leg. But you guys had a tape that apparently made it around to a few friends.
Yeah.
And then you went in with David Barrick and did a full-on CD. It was a cassette.
It was only a cassette.
That's right.
We had to make it. Well, you had a hand in that. We had to make Frankenstein the CD back together and try to kind of, quote-unquote, remaster it in sorts. That is the loudest thing I want you to know. That you had that thing pegging the meters. Every time I've tried to put it on tape or at least give it to somebody, you know, I'll just like turn it on.
Dude, it's like, rock and roll, baby. It's supposed to sound like rock and roll. Yeah.
It kicks. It's a good one.
Yeah. So Hoodle Doings is the name of the tape that Daddy Longleg released back in, what was the date on that, or year, like 91?
92-ish, I think.
92. And then my first kind of...
We sold out of them, I think.
How many did you print up, do you know?
I think we only did probably, I don't even know if we did 1,000 of them. It was either 500 or 1,000.
Yeah.
Whatever the minimum that you had to buy.
Well, I mean, I'd heard...
I still got tons of J cards from it, though.
I'd heard of Daddy Long Leg, but I think you guys broke up for a little while.
Yeah.
And then when I was at the College Station, you guys popped in there one night about sometime, I'm going to say 94, 95. You guys were, I guess, kind of getting back together to do a couple of shows or something.
Yeah. We tried to get back in there. It just seemed like a lot of the fates were kind of against us. I mean, there was just a lot of bad juju kicking around. I mean, we did do a couple of pretty good shows. I think we did one at Tidballs. It was pretty well received. But and we tried to do a few more, but it just, you know...
Everybody's got life going on,
yeah,
man. You know,
and it was just harder and harder to get everybody.
I mean, as you get a little bit older, you have more responsibilities, you got more things going on, you got families.
Yeah.
It's not like when you're 18, 19, 20 years old and you got like a girlfriend and that's it, and you got a part-time gig somewhere that you're there maybe 30 hours a week and you're able to do all that stuff. When you get a little bit older, you got more responsibilities.
Yeah.
So let's say Daddy Long Leg 91, you got the cassette out, then you went a couple of years, and then you got back together a couple of times. And through the years, you guys have done a show here or there.
Mm.
But where all did you guys play the initial, get-together go-around?
We did a lot of gigs. A lot of our initial gigs were at Picasso's.
Mm-hmm.
We played it a lot at this place called Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the name of the
Cross
place.
The Track?
Yeah, Cross the Track. I think it was a college bookstore after that and a couple other things. And I think that's where we lost the big banner that we had painted up for us. I think
we had a banner painted up and somebody stole it?
Yeah, we had a huge banner, and I think we just pretty much just left it at the bar. I don't know. Somebody's got it in their living room somewhere, and so, you know.
Okay.
If you're listening, if you've got the banner, give it back. Whatever.
No questions asked. Drop it at the secret location.
I hope you've enjoyed it. So,
yeah.
Whatever.
We'd love to
wrapped up in it in the winter or whatever.
Hole in the house we want to cover up.
Yeah. That's pretty much probably all it's good for. And then Gary's was another place that I think is probably, I don't even know if that building is still, I think most of those buildings are around that area.
I think Western's kind of claimed all of it.
Stomped and flattened to the ground, yeah.
But I believe that's the reason that you guys were up with me that night is because you were doing a show at Gary's.
Yeah.
Because around that same time, I interviewed Sixth Floor. And it was their first time on the radio and their first time being interviewed and their first time being played and blah, blah, blah. And at that time, Sixth Floor...
Did they do the show with us?
I don't think it was... I think it was, a couple weeks apart or whatever. I don't think you guys. I didn't interview that same night.
Yeah, okay.
But that was the first interview that I'd ever done was with Sixth Floor ever, and it was their first interview. And John's always asked me if I have that, and I was like, man, I wish I did, but that's one of the things I don't have. But not long after that, you guys popped up there, Daddy Long Leg there, and I think you were doing a show at Gary's, and that's the reason you're up there. So Gary's and Picasso's, now I know there have been some live shows circulating through the years. Do you still have some of those?
Yeah, I've got a few of those. I know we've got a couple of the Gary's shows. I know we've got probably one of the, I don't know if it was the first or second night of the Picasso. I think we did two or three nights at Picasso's, and I know we've got one of them. There's some video of us. I think there might be video of the Picasso's one and maybe Sawmill, and I think there is also one of the Stage Stop show.
In Memphis.
The audio is not real great on it, but
how about Yankee Doodles? Did you guys do any shows at Yankee Doodles?
we did Doodles too. I've remembered. I don't think we had any of those taped. I know there's pictures from them, but I don't think we had any tapes from them.
That's a cool band. Anybody out there that's really interested in the local music scene, not only what's going on now, but some stuff that has happened in the past, do yourself a favor and seek out anything you get your eyes or ears on Daddy Long Leg. That was a pretty badass band back in the day. So after that, like I said before, you've been in many, many, many bands, so we're just going to hop around a little bit because this would have to be like a 10-part series to cover everything you've done. So the next place I'm going to go is with Jason and the Scorchers. So what year and how did all that come about?
Let's see. I believe Jason was in 2003, I want to say. And because I'd been, I think, off work for a little bit, and I get this call one morning, and it's Warner Hodges.
The Warner Hodges.
And I'm like, oh, wow. It's like I got your name from Tommy Womack, and we've got a kind of short list of drummers, and you know, we were kind of in a big pinch because our main guy, Perry, is not able to go on this tour. They had a couple of dates booked. So they had a small little Texas jaunt booked, but they also had one in Norway.
Gosh.
And Perry wanted, he kind of made some kind of unreasonable demands of the band, and they just, you know, they couldn't guarantee him what he wanted, so he kind of blew up, and, you know, and that was that. So they had those dates on the books. I don't know if they were, at the time, I think they were going to honor those commitments, and I think that was probably, you know, at the time it was going to be, that was going to be it, because they didn't think they really could carry on. And how it played out, I wasn't able to do the Norway show with them because the plane ticket was in Perry's name. So their fix for that was to get a guy that Jason had played with over there, a guy named Pontus Snibb.
And made that up, didn't you?
No. I mean, that's such a great name.
It is a great name. I mean, it's like the name you use when you don't want anybody to know this. What's your name? Yeah, my name is whatever he said.
Inflated Ballsack. Anyway, I don't know. So that name came up. And
say it one more time.
Pontus Snibb.
Sure.
Norwegian guy, great guy, really, really beautiful guy, and he's actually he's got a pretty accomplished dude. He's got a band of his own called Bonafide over there. He plays guitar in that band.
Wow, talented!
And he plays drums in a Zeppelin tribute band over there too.
My gosh!
So, yeah, but anyway, they met with him, I think, about an hour before they went on, and he knew the stuff backwards and forwards, and nailed it.
Wow!
say anywhere. We'll come back to him later.
Okay.
Because it all kind of keys into to what happens. But I had the daunting task of learning probably the other, you know, third or two-thirds of their repertoire and stuff. About roughly 50, 70-something songs, I guess, over, you know, some albums they pretty much did, like, the first couple of releases, they did almost everything, and then some other ones they cherry-picked and stuff. But so I got down in my basement with my newly purchased V-Drums, the electronic kit that I'd gotten, and that thing saved my butt. Because I was down there pretty much every night practicing those things.
Mm-hmm.
And showed up to the first practice, and Jason's like, damn, he knows all the stuff. Uh-huh. He knows it better than we do. So we set off on that the first couple of weekend dates. I think there was one in Dallas, one in Houston. We did Antone's. I think that might have been in Houston. I can't remember. Or maybe that's in Austin. I can't mm-hmm. remember.
Yeah, I think you gave me a copy of that show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know there's one that somebody recorded, which is probably the only live recording of me with the band, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you guys jumped in the car, went to Texas, did a couple of shows in Texas, and then they said, all right, now we're going overseas. Because didn't you go overseas with them? No, that wasn't with the Scorchers.
That was, I did do, but that was later on.
I thought that was just Warner with his band. Or did you go with
that was Warner's band.
Okay, all right. So Scorchers.
Well, we did do, Scorchers did a one-off in Oviedo, Spain.
Uh-huh.
Which is probably it was a kind of a cool experience, and it was kind of a crappy experience all in one. Because from looking at it from the, you know, average Joe's perspective, the Crossroads Festival, as it was touted, was supposed to be a really big to-do. You know, we were, you know, pretty excited to be on it. Well, when we show up and thinking it's going to be in a big, huge venue, well, it's at a big, huge venue in the parking lot of the big, huge venue. Right next to the big, huge stadium. And they've got a small, you know, it's a pretty good size stage set up there. But there's like maybe an audience. That was the first night that we showed up after we got off the plane. And there was maybe about 100 people standing out there watching some of the bands. And I can't remember how many people that were in the audience for ours. I hoped it was a little bit more than that. But, I mean, there is video on YouTube out there of at least some of the stuff. I don't know if it's the full set.
Jason the Scorchers playing where now?
Oviedo, Spain at the Crossroads Festival.
Okay.
And so at the end of the show, we get all the gear together and everything, and Jason, I guess, goes to get the check, and the promoter hands him this check, and he just kind of looks at it, and it's like, he tells us later on, he thinks to himself, this is no good.
Uh-huh.
And we find out that it really wasn't any good. The other part of the Georgia Satellites, the two Ricks at the time, had their band the night before, and they had only managed to get half their money from mm-hmm. this guy. And so apparently the promoter had, you know, overextended himself, and he was stiffing everybody left and right.
Mm-hmm.
So if we and it was on a Saturday, we couldn't get the check cashed there until, well, we were told we could only get that check cashed in the town that it was written in.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we'd gotten over to Madrid, we were pretty much SOL.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, a lot of that money was, you know, was supposed to kind of bankroll part of the rest of, you know, Warner's tour that was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of limped through that, but we did all right.
Yeah.
It was a hard lesson. And he said himself, it was probably one of the hardest tours that he had done.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many shows did you do with Jason and the Scorchers total, do you think?
it was a couple of years, and I think we only did, like, you know, small little kind of jaunts and stuff, weekend jaunts. So
maybe less than 50?
That's probably kind of a close approximation. I don't even know if it was that many, but, you know, I didn't really keep track of them too much because I was, you know, I was just kind of like, this is, you know, this is cool. But, yeah, I mean, we played up in Chicago. I know we played Minneapolis. We did, these are all the Midwest tour that we did the year after we did the Texas thing.
What about a recording? Are you on any recordings? I know you're on a Christmas song, right?
Yeah, that was my only official recording with the band. A revamped version of Oh Holy Night that, and then we tracked it at Gary Talent. Yes, the Gary Talent from the E Street Band. He has a studio in Nashville. Real, really nice dude. And he had a tape that him and Nils had done back when they were kids, and it was kind of a rocked up version of it. And that's kind of what we were kind of going for, kind of that treatment of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Perry actually sings backups on that one. He came in and did backup vocals after we did the backing tracks and stuff.
So full Jason the Scorchers is actually on that track, but the drumming, who's not there?
Kenny Ames was the bass player on that one. Jeff Johnson was not in the band at that time. They did manage to get, when we were inducted into the Americana Festival or whatever.
You guys were inducted into the Americana Hall of Fame?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And they managed to get a hold of Jeff, and they got, this was one of Perry's, I don't know if it was his final gig with them, but it was probably one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they got them all together to play after the, well, they played during the show, and then they played a little bit afterwards, and then I played with them later on that night. But yeah, it was pretty cool. It was a pretty cool night.
Yeah. Now, what year was that when all that went down?
I think that was probably 2004, 2005.
Mm-hmm. Mid-2000s.
Yeah, something like that.
Warner, you went out, you and he and a couple other dudes, Toddzilla.
Mm-hmm.
You guys had Disciples of Loud.
Yeah. They already had, they were already playing around a bit. They had 15 strings drummer, Matt Green,
mm-hmm.
was playing with him. He had to kind of back out for a while because he was having some health problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think some stomach problems or something. And Warner had mentioned it to me, and I said, yeah, I'll play it. And so, you know, just like that, I was in that band. And that, at the time, I don't know if Daddy Long Leg was loud, but I think that was probably the loudest two guitarists I think I've ever played with. It's like being in a Sonic sandwich.
It was called Disciples of Loud.
Yeah, you got Warner on one side and Todd on the other, and me in the middle. Like, oh my God. I literally, I mean, because I usually just played my old banger snare, the premier snare that I played for forever, you know, not the one that I used with the leg, but I actually brought that one out of retirement just to hear the dang thing, and actually had them put the snare in the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
I never do that
because mm-hmm.
I could not hear it.
It was that loud.
It was so freaking loud.
Yeah.
He was like,
who's playing the Dr. Pepper can?
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Louder.
So, the Disciples of Loud, I know you guys recorded some songs, but you didn't actually release anything, did you?
They have an album that they did with Matt.
And before that's what you?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I did do some tracks with them at that time after we got kind of rolling a little bit, because he had it about 4 or 5 or so, I want to say, tracks that he'd written since that first rundown. Because I don't know, you don't have a copy of that one? Did I not give you one?
I've got some tracks. I don't know if it's a copy of something you actually released, or it's just some tracks that you guys
He actually had. Did. I think he did put it out in some fashion. Maybe in just more of just selling it to shows and stuff.
Yeah, I've got something, but I don't know if it's exactly what that is, or it's just some tracks. Like, because I'm thinking that maybe you gave me some tracks before they were done. And you were kind of like, Warner said you could have these and you could spend them a time or two.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if I have the finished product or not. But that band was, what, just a couple of years maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. Not very long.
Yeah. And kind of nowadays, of course, we're doing some big jumps here. You're spending a lot of time with Andy and the Rockers, mm-hmm. weren't you, and Toad Strangler?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now that's almost the same band, isn't it?
Yeah, there's kind of a rotating guitarist, well, two guitarists that kind of rotate, because the basic, the lineup of Andy and the Rockers, when I joined, it was Andrea Tenero, her husband Tony, Randy Thomas on bass, Jenny Smith Brown on backing vocals and some lead, and Andy's brother Clint on rhythm and lead guitar,
mm-hmm.
and a drummer. And they had went through several drummers, and Steve Sanders had emailed me and said, man, you need to try out for those guys. They're having drummer problems pretty bad, man. You'd be good on here. Say, okay. So I looked him up, and I, you know, at first I was like, well, you know, here goes nothing. And I get a call from Tony, and I mean, he, you know, even before I'd met Andy, I mean, he pretty much had me sold on her, you know, because, I mean, he was doing a pretty hard sell at the mm-hmm. time. But I didn't really even know, you know, what to expect. And I get a call from her, and, you know, it's kind of like, you know, and she'll kill me for this. I mean, she's got, if you've ever talked to Andy, she's got a very, you know, distinct, you know, country accent, and a lot of people say that she sounds like Reba McEntire. She's like, I like Reba, but I hate when they say that.
You know? Uh-huh.
So it was like she didn't really, you know, I was, you know, expecting kind of, you know, like sweet little, you know, voice on the other side, and she was just, you know, pretty. What do I want to say? It wasn't quite what I was expecting, but at the, once we got to the actual rehearsal, which we had actually all the time, every time that we rehearsed in the early days, it was up at Guntown Mountain.
Because mm-hmm. she worked there, right?
Yeah, they all worked there. There's a history with them, you know, that goes back years and years, and uh-huh. you know. Andy and Tony met there, and, you know, I mean, it's...
During a gunfight.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, they all played in the... There was a house band that played there, and it was basically Andy and the Rockers.
Yeah.
With the owner, our co-owner, one of the owners of Guntown, Wayne Sexton, who I've played with since then, and Wayne's a great dude. So I got there, and they haven't really given me a... I mean, they had a very... pretty large list of songs, and I don't know if I had a copy of the album or just to maybe kind of browse through a couple of tracks. I didn't really know how to really prepare for it, and we plugged in, and the minute she started singing, I'm like,
she's awesome.
Whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah, she's awesome,
and
isn't she?
They
yeah.
all locked in, and I'm like going, oh, geez, these guys they're tight as hell.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, God, I'm going to have to do some homework here. And, but it was just, you know, they welcomed me in like, you know, a long lost friend, like, you know, I was, you know, had been there for, with them, you know, or known them forever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I mean, a lot of them had, I mean, Tony and, Randy were in a band called Young Billy Walker mm-hmm. years and years ago. And Andy, that was one of Andy's favorite bands
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So they had a lot of history between the members already, but you know, and they knew of me, and I think the going joke was, you know, Tony was like, oh, you know, he doesn't want to play with us, man. He wants to play with something heavier.
Uh-huh.
And they were all like, you know, we really didn't think he would even call us back or anything when we talked to you.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know if you would, you know, want to play with us. And I was like, well, I would not want to play with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, we, you know, and the minute we, you know, started playing and started, you know, doing gigs together, we really hit it off. And it's been a really, really great gig. for me, you know, still to this day.
How many years you've been playing with those guys?
Jeez. I'd say we've probably been going, I know it's been more than 5 years, mm-hmm. a lot more, and I just can't quite put a date on it.
Are you on the Andy and the Rockers CD?
I am and I'm not.
That must have been where you first joined the band.
The original CD has a guy, Buddy, what's his last name? Elkin, maybe? Forgive me. But I know his first name's Buddy. He actually, he was playing with them, and he had the money pretty much to bankroll the CD, and mm-hmm. I think they, in exchange for that, he wanted to play on it and produce it. So, so he's on all of the original. We recut the drums on Taking Care of Mama when it was re-released to country radio a couple years back. Mm-hmm. And Barrick, I don't think he remixed it much. I think he just pretty much just recorded me and then, you know, we put it out.
Tweaked it in somehow.
Tweaked it, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you heard the version on the radio, that is me. Mm-hmm. And actually there are, you know, every copy of the record that we've put out has that version on it since then.
Also, Live in the Rain, Toad Strangler.
Yeah. You're Toad on that. Strangler is, yeah, that is all me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Are those the only two releases you guys have done?
That's, save for a couple of songs that we had tracked for some misguided venture, mm-hmm. which there's nothing wrong with those songs. They will probably see the light of day on the next album.
Okay. So you guys are already talking about maybe doing something.
Yeah. I mean, we've got everything right now at our disposal to actually do an album ourselves.
That would be nice.
So I don't see any reason why we can't do one. And we're all chomping at the bit to kind of get, you know, I know Tony's got some songs and I think we probably want to get in there and maybe just kind of knock around some riffs and figure out, you know, what works and what doesn't. So
Let me just throw out some names, some ideas here, and you just give me a couple of sentences on each. Is that cool?
This is like
your thoughts on these different okay. things. French TV.
Oh boy. French TV was that was actually my first or second, but it was probably the first album project that I think I was ever involved with.
Is this pre-Go-Go Surreal?
Pre-Go-Go Surreal. This is before I even went to college, back in like 82 or 83, with a guy named Mike Seri and his friend who I had met at Vine Records in Louisville, Kentucky, Steve Roberts, who was a, both of those guys were big, huge prog rock heads. And Steve, he, I don't know if he still has his own, I don't know if it was a, it wasn't a label. I think it was, he actually had like an ordering, music ordering service that, he had a lot of prog rock stuff that he could, you know, order and, or you could order from him stuff. I mean, all over the place. I mean, he had a huge, huge record collection of stuff. And, he was the keyboardist in that band, the original keyboardist. Mike Seri was the bass player, and we had brought in a friend of mine from high school, little guy named Artie Bratton, to play guitar. The kid was literally, I think he was 15 years old at the time, mm-hmm. and playing out of his mind already. We were just like, because on one particular track, he kept on like, you know, I can do it better. And like, already, I don't think it's going to get any better. I mean, it's already great as it is. And he was just all over it. But we had him and...
Did that band actually release anything?
Oh, yeah. Well, we did. We put that... We put... two albums out on vinyl I know of that I am on. The third one, I don't know if that ever came out on vinyl. I think it was just on I've only got it on a tape.
What's the name of the album? French TV what?
Well, it was French TV 2, which was called After a Lengthy Silence, French TV 3, Virtue and Futility. And then after that, he hasn't stopped.
What about Wayne Kramer?
Wayne Kramer.
MC5. That's right.
Man. Yeah, that was an amazing thing. I still don't recall. I think it was just kind of a word of mouth thing that my friend Brad Jones got me in on. And he just said, yeah, Wayne's doing an album and I want you to play on it. And
is this when Wayne was living in Nashville? Because I think he was in Nashville for a while.
He was doing demos. We only did about, I know it was two or three songs. Of the one that I've got a rough for was called Crack in the Universe. And that did appear on the Hard Stuff album that they put out on Epitaph about a year or two later.
With you on drums?
No.
No, you just did demos.
Yeah, it didn't come out. Mm-hmm. Our versions. There may have been another song that I did, but I know that there was one more, just this jazz free, improv thing that popped up, and I didn't even know about it. I didn't even know that they had released it until this girl that worked at Pack Rats hipped me onto it. I think she actually had the CD, and it was called Motor City's Burning, and it had Wayne and Brad and I and their poet friend
John Sinclair
mm-hmm. was doing kind of a tripped out vocal on top of it.
Hmm.
So that was the only thing. I mean, I did get, some redemption there.
Yeah.
And that to actually do with it. And I picked his brain actually when I saw he opened up for Cheap Trick in Owensboro several years back. And it was a pretty cool opener gig. And they did stuff from, I don't know if they did much from Hard Stuff. I can't remember the name of the album they were touring on. Adult something. Anyway, he was at the t-shirt booth and, signing autographs and selling the CDs and stuff. And I came up to him and was like, hey, Wayne, you remember doing some demos and stuff in Nashville with a couple of guys? Like, yeah. He was like, you're the drummer, aren't you? And he remembered it, and he was like, yeah, well, that was serious business, man. That was going to be an album, But we just decided to, take it a little bit further,
Yeah.
But, yeah, he remembered it.
That's cool.
He shook my hand and everything, and he was a good guy.
Yeah, I've always heard good things.
He had a lot of stories.
Oh, gosh, how could you not?
he had a lot of stories.
Now, off of band, as far as bands you've played with, how about Kiss? Aren't you a big Kiss fan?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you were actually in Kiss, were you?
No. If you count the one night that Tommy Womack's band actually got to dress up one night at the Sutler.
Uh-huh.
That was my one shining moment, I guess.
You dressed up like Peter Criss?
Yeah.
Who's the best drummer in Kiss out of the three that they've had?
They're all good dudes.
Technically, who's the
technically,
best? As a drummer, who do you think is the best drummer?
I always got to give it to Peter. it's just a purist type thing. Because, and a lot of people will tell you this. They were pretty much the reason I started playing drums.
Kiss
was.
Mm-hmm.
And it blew my head off, in 1976 or 77 when Rock and Roll Over came out and Dr. Love was on the radio, and man, I was like, wow, this is cool. And then, you see the costumes and, all the other, and the magazines and everything. And I was in there hook, line, and sinker with everybody else. And I had just gotten a drum set, I think about the year after, I think, and took every single one of those albums downstairs in this old Magnavox record player. It tore to shreds out of the grooves, but I cranked that thing up and I played every single one of those things backwards and forwards until I, you know, pretty much knew them. Mm-hmm. And that was my initial lessons, I guess, in rock and roll. Still, you know, remember playing those things all these years.
Was Rock and Roll Over your first Kiss record?
Yeah, that was the first one.
You went and bought it with your own money? And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you still have that very one you bought?
Yeah.
Do you really?
And like an idiot. Well, actually, I do have the sticker is stuck on my childhood toy box, which I rescued from my parents' home.
Uh-huh.
Before they moved out, which had all these other great Marvel stickers and stuff, but the Rock and Roll Over stickers on there too.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool, and you still got it.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Now, you mentioned superheroes. I know you're into superheroes a lot. Who are some of your favorite superheroes?
Once again, I'm a purist as far as that goes. Anything that Jack Kirby drew back in the day, of Fantastic Four, Thor, Hulk's probably in there. I don't know if it's a if he runs a close second, but I mean, Spider-Man is probably those. They're probably the top three, I would imagine.
I really thought you'd say Batman as one of them.
Well, Batman's in there. Yeah. I mean, I was always a Marvel kid, but Batman is definitely in there.
Of the superhero movies they've been putting out the past few years, which one you think's the best?
Well, the most enjoyable one here of late, I'm wearing on my chest. I can't believe they got away with some of the stuff in Deadpool. The first Avengers movie was awfully good.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy that one. I wish they would do a standalone movie with Hulk with Mark Ruffalo, because I think he's really brought that character quite a ways from. I mean, they've done two Hulk movies, but the first one was the second one. I just can't wrap my head around Ed Norton's performance, a lot of people loved it, but you know, he didn't get along with the producers too well. I know that, so he broke off with them.
Yeah,
but Ruffalo has been just. I think he's really saved the character for me.
What's your favorite Star Wars movie?
I can't put my finger on the one, but it always goes back. I mean, I know the first one is always, you know, going to be, you know, the one that everybody goes back to, because it was, you know, that was the thing that started it all. But the first three are really, you watch one, you got to watch the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them, you know, it's... They tried. I'm sorry.
Now, we talked about music a little bit. You mentioned Kiss. I brought up Kiss. We talked about Kiss a little bit. What are two or three other bands that you're really into?
Oh.
Favorite bands, favorite records, favorite concert?
Well, anybody who knows me and anybody who's watched me and or has seen the drum kit that I have refused to retire over the years, at least the last 5 or 10 years, knows that I'm a diehard Who fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I've pretty much gotten almost everything they've ever put out, at least as a band.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have everything, but I've got quite a bit.
What's the Who album? If somebody right now is listening and you're talking about the Who and they're like, oh yeah, I've heard of those guys, what record do they need to go get and check out? One record.
You know, it varies. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, Tommy was the best one. And I do like Tommy quite a bit. But I always catch myself going for Quadrophenia was really, that one really hit me pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, people didn't really understand it as I read when they first started performing it, the album hadn't even been released yet, and these kids were out there going, "This is great, man, but I don't know what's going on," you know. So, you know, it's a pretty heavy story, you know, kind of a, you know, adolescence in London or whatever, and Jimmy, who goes through, you know, I mean, he's just whacked out on pills and just trying to kind of find his identity and kind of, you know, confesses that he's just turned into, you know, he's not a schizophrenic, he's a quadriphenic, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. And it the whole concept thing of it and the themes and the way they work them into the songs. I mean, Tommy did the same thing, but I think Quadrophenia actually did it better, mm-hmm, in my honest opinion.
Well, we're about ready to wrap this up, and I think we've touched base on quite a lot of the bands that you've been in through the years, and there's no way we can get to all of them. We got to a lot of them. I think we got to the kind of high points, mm-hmm, but is there anything that you would like to add or put in there before we end the interview, or anything you want to ask me, final thoughts, anything like that?
It's always put me on the spot, but
that's what I do.
Think probably, I guess, the takeaway from all this, I mean, if, you know, is like Tommy says, I mean, y'all got to get out there and support local music, because, I mean, I have a sordid history, you know, with it since I've been here. And there's just a wealth of great musicians and kids and stuff still out there hitting it hard. I mean, and a lot of them I played with, and some of them I haven't even seen yet. And but they're every bit as dedicated as I was. And it's, you know, it's really just, you know, warms my heart that there still is a very, you know, a burgeoning music scene in this town that is still alive and well. And there is still, you know, seems to be a pretty healthy audience out there to support it.